Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 24th of August, 2015, here in Japan. And today we're going to be talking about a new documentary film, Dark Clouds Over Elberton, The True Story of the Georgia Guidestones. And unlike most films that you would expect to see under such a title, this film actually does some real investigative research about the Georgia Guidestones and discovers, I think, puts together a pretty convincing open and shut case who was actually behind the erecting of this monument, I guess we can call it, for the time being, provisionally. Very interesting documentary, well worth your time to view, especially if you're interested in finding out who was actually behind placing these guidestones there. In order to help parse our way through all of this, we're joined on the line today by Dr. J. Michael Bennett, who is one of the associate producers on the film and did a lot of the ground legwork, the gumshoe reporting, to actually put this pretty startling documentary together. Dr. Bennett, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
It is such a pleasure. I've wanted to make contact with you and your program for such a long time. I have been a fan from a distance for a number of years, and I'm not saying that because you're talking about this documentary. I truly admire your work, and that's why I wanted to share this with you and your listeners, because I know they're truth seekers like I am, and hopefully this actually provides a little bit of truth on this mystery.
Yes, well, I think it certainly does. And as I say, I think this is a pretty convincing case that you've put together for the actual identity of the person or people, I guess, behind this the Georgia Guidestones. But yes, for those in the audience who might be familiar with the Revelation Radio News podcast that I've mentioned a number of times with previous guests, Tim Kilkenny and Andrew Hoffman. Yes, this is Dr. Future of Futurequake, who Tim and Andrew like to refer to as, I think, one of the best podcasters of all time, something along those lines. So you have some pretty big shoes to fill here, or at least to live up to, a reputation to live up to. But let's do our best.
Please start.
All right. Well, let's actually start the groundwork for this conversation. For the three or four people in the audience who may not have heard of the Georgia Guidestones, just tell us a little bit about the background of this mystery. What are these Guidestones? When were they erected? What do we know about them?
Some people call it a monument. Others call it a monolith. It's best known as America's Stonehenge, which gives a little bit of a hint of what their purpose was. They are a vision of supposedly a small group of loyal Americans, as they describe themselves, led by a man who used a pseudonym called R.C. Christian. And they wanted to use this as a permanent remembrance monument of what their view is of how society, the world at large, civilization could survive in the eras ahead. It was conceived over a couple of decades, according to their testimony, and they initiated this project in 1979. This was still at the time when the Cold War was raging. There was concerns about the Iron Curtain, the Russians and the Americans going into thermonuclear war. But their biggest concern were other issues, such as overpopulation. And so this led them to build a structure that they felt would survive if humanity survived for many, many generations, thousands of years. It would withstand this period of time and have these guidestones, almost like a Ten Commandments. There were ten guidelines for humanity to survive. On how they could live and prosper in the world of the future.
Well, then let's talk about what is actually inscribed on these guidestones, because there are sort of a list of 10 commandments, I suppose you could call them, on here. What do they talk about?
Some of them are pretty innocuous. You know, live in harmony with nature, avoid useless laws and petty officials. These are the kind of things that are just for a peaceable society. Some of them are more eyebrow-raising, like have a world court to make binding decisions, a world government, a common language.
Hello? Mike, are you there?
Yes.
Sorry, you just cut out there for a second.
Okay.
World court to make binding decisions, and
Yes, and also to have a single world government, basically to have a unified, coordinated world government. But some of the commandments, particularly the first one, is what is most alarming to most people, where it talks about maintaining a worldwide human population of 500 million in harmony with nature. And now, of course, we're at a population of 7 billion plus. So that means that well over 90% of the population would have to disappear, according to their vision, to be able to have a sustainable population. And that gets a lot of attention of the many visitors and tourists that come there. Loads of documentaries have been produced on the History Channel and National Geographic and elsewhere. And so this has puzzled society about what was the purposes behind this operation, and particularly the identity of R.C. Christian, which was the front man who initiated the project with the people in Elberton, Georgia, where the monument was actually constructed.
That's right. And just to add to the sort of druidic, paganistic nature of this, there's also kind of an astronomical aspect to these guidestones as well. Perhaps you can tell us about that.
And even that provides a little bit of a guesswork as to what its purpose is. I think part of the reason, when I've read R.C. Christian's writings, was to give it a timeless quality like other ancient sites, like Stonehenge and others, which are actually aligned with certain astronomical events unique to the orbit of the Earth. It was actually positioned to be perfectly aligned with the north, south, east, and west, and to actually have certain apertures that were drilled into it that could actually observe the sun at the solstices, at the equinoxes, to basically see where in the calendar we are at any given particular time. There are also additional holes that are cut that are focused on the North Star, where we can determine our positioning system based upon the alignment of the guidestones at any time of the year. So it gives people a general feel that this is something that could reconstruct the basics of civilization if there were some sudden cataclysm. I'm not even sure if that's the main purpose of it, based upon their writing. It was not so much their main emphasis as so much to prevent a cataclysm from occurring and to basically let this monument show that it's intended to be in harmony with nature and the world, and that humanity and civilization would be in sync, basically, with the whole ebb and flow of the universe.
Right. And as you mentioned, they have become a magnet for tourists in a lot of different ways. But of course, there is the protest aspect of this, with the guidestones regularly being defaced and vandalized and graffitized. Tell us about the reaction the public has had over the decades to these guidestones.
Well, you know, within more what we would know as the New Age type community, they see it as somewhat of a sacred site. Yoko Ono and others have come forward and said it's a real monument to peace. There is a certain connection of the site with the Cherokees, who call it the navel of the world at the location in rural Georgia where it's located. You even have some of the darker left-hand path type occultic people that use it for certain kind of services. Also, Wiccans come out there and do their earth services because it's really in concert with their activities that are in alignment with sacred events and in the moving in the cosmos. And then on the other end, you have certain evangelical Christians and fundamentalists who feel like it's a tool of the Antichrist that are intended to eliminate a large portion of the earth's population, and that the people who may be behind it may have some connection with future events that would jeopardize a large part of the world.
All right, so I guess that brings us, that sets the table pretty well for this documentary. Tell us about how this documentary came together and how you came to be a part of it.
Well, I have an acquaintance with a very impressive documentary filmmaker by the name of Chris Pinto. I had bumped into one of his works called Riddles in Stone, which had a big effect on my evolution, that got into the background of some of the ancient occultic ideas or ideas that came from illuminated sources like Francis Bacon and others regarding the New Atlantis that had percolated their way even into the speeches and writing of people like George W. Bush and others. And I was very impressed with his line of thinking, at least in that vein of his work, and the quality of his work. And he had ended up moving from Southern California to Nashville, where I reside. And so we had an on and off contact. He visited sometimes on the show. I attended church where I go. But he had mentioned that he wanted to do a documentary in this, and he was aware of some of my investigative proclivities, and then asked me if I would assist him in what was originally intended to be a very modest effort to try to do a definitive documentation of the key people that were behind it, where we could do a very high quality recording in their own words before they passed away, because many of the figures in Elberton are very elderly now, to actually find out really what the truth is and what was going on and the purpose. And what happened in the course of it in our first visit was a Pandora's box literally was opened to us at the visit, and it totally took our work in a different direction, where suddenly real legitimate revelations were coming into our hands that everyone else thought had long been non-existent or would never be solved.
Exactly right. So let's talk about some of the characters that we encounter in this film and how those pieces come together. For example, Wyatt Marden and Jim Findlay and Shirley McNeely and other people like that.
It's quite a cast. And one of the things that I think is unique about this documentary, what I liked about it, is that it's not just a dry recitation of information. And it's also not a phony, false melodrama that you see in a lot of cable documentaries that are inserted into these. It actually is a real unfolding drama, real time in front of the camera, with some fascinating people from the heartland of America that have almost a cognitive dissonance. While they're very strongly of Bible values on one side, they can sort of coexist with almost pseudo-occultic teachings at the same time. And that comes across in this motley crew that we have on. All of the major key players, there's one that's deceased, Joe Findlay, who was the construction foreman of the project. We interviewed his son, who shared with us a little bit of information about his father's role, including the fact that at one point R.C. Christian called and said he wanted to reveal himself to the world, and they requested that he not. Because they wanted to keep the mystery the way it was, and obviously it was for the betterment of their public relations and Chamber of Commerce to keep the tourists going if this was not solved. But some of the other figures that were involved, including Wayne Mullinex, who was the gentleman who provided the land and eventually dug the foundations for it, including possibly the time capsule. And that was a very, very tense interview, if you notice, watching the documentary. There's a couple moments in the documentary that are almost Hitchcock-like in the tension, and it was purely unintended, and it just happened naturally. When we started asking him about the presence of a time capsule, who would open it, when it would be opened, under what conditions, very interesting gentleman, very kind, cordial man, opened his home, a cattleman, largely. With a little side business, which is not uncommon in rural South. But like most of the men who worked on this were Freemasons and were used to keeping secrets. And so that was a very interesting interview with him. He opened the door to a gentleman who's virtually unknown in the whole Gadstones lore, and that is Frank Coggins, who we were told was one of the richest men in the state of Georgia, and actually owned several cities, resort cities that had been built in Georgia. And in the documentary, you see a little picture we saw in his home with Rosalind Carter. Actually, he ran in high circles, but he was in extremely poor health. He was on oxygen at the time, and he has since deceased since we filmed his interview. But he was one of the key movers and shakers in the town that it appears by our data helped provide some key money for the land to procure it and really helped promote it and wanted to promote it for the betterment of Elberton. But the key interview that we did was with Wyatt Marden, which is the banker who was the real interface with the man known as R.C. Christian, who represented the group that designed the monument, who commissioned it, provided the funding for it, and he's the only man who has ever claimed to know the true identity of R.C. Christian. It was a requirement for him to handle his banking funds. He said due to regulatory requirements, he would have to know the true identity and took a vow never to reveal it. And he had been interviewed a number of times. And in fact, one of the most curious things was not long before then, I believe it was Wired Magazine interviewed him. And it came up that there had been a computer case, an IBM computer case, that he had kept all the correspondence with R.C. Christian. And he refused to let anybody see it. Other articles had said it had been destroyed. But it looked like it was a lost piece of information. And while interviewing him, and this was early in our production of this documentary, We found out that it did indeed exist on the premises, on the ground where we interviewed him at his home. And you can actually see on camera the documentary, the process of us being able to persuade him to allow us to see it and even look inside the contents.
Exactly right. And in a way, I almost feel sad for Wyatt Martin in this documentary, because he certainly had every intention of keeping the secrets all the way to his grave, but it looks like he revealed some of them, including some very important secrets that were encased in that case that basically led you to the actual person itself involved. It's a fascinating thing to watch. As you say, it does unfold on camera, it kind of in real time as all of these things are developing. But I guess let's cut to the chase. You basically, I don't think it's 100%. We can't definitively say this is the case, but we can, with a lot of confidence, say who actually was R.C. Christian. Tell us about the where this trail ultimately ended up leading you.
Okay. Let me just say regarding Mr. Martin, who I think, as you can tell in the documentary, we portray in a very sympathetic light. He is a serious person in his Christian faith. While I may not understand why certain things didn't raise concerns with him, in his own mind, he did nothing wrong in his role in producing this. And I think we captured the sincerity of himself in the documentary. Regarding what he allowed us to see, and I believe you noticed this on camera, everything we saw, we asked permission to see. Anything he shared with us, he just asked us not to ask the direct name of R.C. Christian, which we complied with. He gave us permission to film inside the case that he had kept, which before, again, there were not even rumors that it even existed. But when we were allowed to see in it, it was he who made this information available to our cameras where we could actually see. So we left with his good graces. I followed up with him, and we were still and we're on good terms, you know, on what we had. And, you know, what he allowed indirectly for us to view, I really don't know. I can't say was he relieved or allowed indirectly without breaking his vow to allow us to be privy to see certain things. We'll never know. That's the kind of thing gentlemen don't ask each other when they proceed. But everything was done within bounds of what his permission and what we did. But regarding the identity itself, what we're talking about is actual hard data that we began to see. And it was not the only surprising data we collected on this adventure. But through looking through the letters, and he even shared a letter with us on camera from R.C. Christian, read it. From that, we could find out the age, the year of birth of R.C. Christian, other things about his background. But the things that really riveted us in it was an actual glimpse we saw on camera of an address from the state of Iowa, actually, a specific address we could see, and also another name that was present. On some of the correspondence where promotional material about this was sent to the Smithsonian elsewhere, which actually Wyatt Martin even assisted this group with in the years afterwards. And so we had a name and an address and a state, and that's where I did most of the investigative work to find out where this fell in place. And what we discovered is that the name was not affiliated with the address that we found, but it did come from the same medium-sized city in Iowa, and it turned out it led to two of the most prominent men in this city. And the rest of the document, as you see, is that these two men, one was the head of the Ohio Daily Newspaper Association at one time. Another one was a very, very prominent surgeon, sort of a Renaissance man. He was a prominent inventor, extremely successful in areas, and actually just a visionary in terms of planning. Was known for books he had written about the future of Iowa, how Iowa could be designed to be living in harmony with nature, and to design future cities that would be consistent with the sustainability themes. So these were two very respectable men that when we eventually went to the city in Iowa, where I had found where they were located, they were a household name, even though one had been deceased since 92 and the other one in 2005. So after a decade or more of death, these men were considered, in a way, city fathers of this major city. And as you see in the documentary, we find even from a sitting district court judge who was a nephew of one of these men that he confirmed, in fact, these men knew each other, were engaged with each other. And one of the areas we briefly alluded to from the town historian was that they had combined on another project regarding a construction in their city square that even involved the gentleman we identify as R.C. Christian having built a small model of the project itself, just like he did when R.C. Christian came to Elberton and presented a model of the Gadstones.
Exactly right. There are so many different pieces of this puzzle that when put together make, as I say, a pretty convincing case that we've found the people involved here. And I don't think even the names of these two people are that important in the ultimately, because as much as they are household names in that city in Iowa, they are absolutely not household names for anyone in the audience who will not have any idea who these people are, I'm sure.
That's right.
So I guess...
And I appreciate you not mentioning them. I hope that if people are that curious, I hope when they get the documentary, they can see those kind of details if they're curious. But there's enough drama there. I think people, along when they watch it, are going to see a very interesting, sort of almost a Da Vinci Code, but in a real true sense.
Exactly right. Yes. No, it very much has that feel to it as you're sort of discovering it as you go along. And the documentary does a wonderful job of putting that together. And it is kind of an exciting process. But at the end of it, here's my take ultimately on this documentary. I think it is important. I think people who are interested in the Guidestones absolutely should see this documentary, but they should see it not, I think, because of the great reveal, this is R.C. Christian, you know, ooh, but actually right. because of the fact that once that air of mystery is pulled away from the Georgia Guidestones and you know, oh, it was this doctor and this person in this town and, there's no, secret Illuminati hooded people behind this. It's not Ted Turner or other people who have been speculated about in the past. And you find out all of the sort of banal aspects of this, like they wanted to have a little pyramid capstone, but they couldn't afford it, so they weren't able to do that. It turns this mystery that's so intimidating and that people feel they have to protest against because, oh, this is the New World Order and everything. It turns it into something almost pathetic. And this is actually gestured at several times in the documentary. As you say, Joe Findlay actually convinced R.C. Christian not to go public with his real name because it would take away from the tourist aspects. And you have Wyatt Martin in this documentary a couple of different times, back when the Guidestones were first erected, and in your own interview with him, saying that there's the mystery to it that keeps people pulling in. I think ultimately what this documentary does is pull that mystery away and turn the Guidestones from something intimidating and something to be feared into really just a kind of pathetic little monument to a couple of people's own ideas and ego.
Well, I agree, and that's part of the benefit of being a devoted truth seeker, is that you can take several Goliaths down to their knees when you demystify a public relations monolith that they build on certain things. But there are some additional things I think that can be learned. And I appreciate your restraint in revealing some details here, but I'll throw out a few bones for your audience here because I think they're important on the lessons learned. Most places that I've seen analysis done on the Guidestones have typically attributed to some extreme left-wing socialist activity that they think is behind it. And what you find out in this is that these people had proclivities with the extreme right. And it was not the extreme left that were the roots of these people. And it sort of reinforces my view that when you go to one extreme or the other, the extreme left or right, they sort of meet around to the back. And basically it just becomes the whole idea of a technocracy or some kind of group of technocrats controlling the masses. It's really a control issue regardless of ideology. But there are some people, including a Nobel laureate, that were actually mentioned, and I'll mention his name on your show. William Shockley's name came up as someone who was at least considered to be an affiliate of the man who we reveal as R.C. Christian, according to testimony of people in town who were privy to Mr. Christian and his activities, which is very interesting when you study more of Shockley's background and his emphasis on preferred races. And when you dig into the books, like, for example, many of your listeners may not be aware that there was a book purportedly written by R.C. Christian called Common Sense Renewed. It has a big picture of the Guidestones on it. It says it's written by Robert Christian, There were copies in the Elberton Library, but also the Granite Association had them for sale. They were supposedly sent to all of the members of Congress and world-leaning officials, and it goes into greater detail with the philosophy of R.C. Christian. And you find, if you really dig through it carefully, that it goes beyond simple sustainability of getting overall population numbers down, which is the number one emphasis, but it really focuses on getting rid of the undesirables. People who are unfit, in their view, due to limited education ability or poor or what they think are cultural things that are unsuitable for humanity. And so really there's a proclivity to winnow out those that they think that are not worthy. And that's really the darker aspects that I think we need to constantly be on the watch for, because these were some very prominent men that were well-respected. They were also sharing these views. And we found in their town that there were some people who were sort of voices crying in the wilderness saying, these views aren't right. They really didn't have the ammunition behind them to show how far these guys were going with their views. And so how big this circle goes, we identify two gentlemen closely aligned. And in fact, the other gentleman in that we mentioned in the book actually has ties to the publishing house that actually published the book that I just mentioned. So we have all sorts of connections that show the associations between them. But at the same time, we see this story goes from the Bible Belt to the Corn Belt in Middle America. And we have two sleepy towns of good, honest, Norman Rockwell type communities and people who can coexist with some pretty ominous thoughts on the side. When you look at the people who were involved in the construction of the Guidestones, this kind of philosophy on the Guidestones was consistent with maybe what they saw in the lodge, the kind of bigger things they saw, but they were regular members of the local Baptist church. I interviewed the pastor there, who was a relatively new pastor, hadn't been there. These people had been there for multiple generations. And he basically said that whole mindset and philosophy was entrenched in that community as well. And myself, I come from that Bible Belt kind of environment. And when you see that dark edge, it almost gives you sort of a Dunwich Horror kind of feel to it. That there is a part to our all shucks kind of cordial mentality that needs to be completely purged and cleansed and brought out in the open. And I think this documentary maybe does a little bit of that in both communities, and says that these kind of ideas that we allow to coexist along with some of the best virtues that we have as Americans really need to come forward and be looked at in the light of day. And so this is maybe one little push in that direction.
Indeed, yes. And it's about the banality of evil, really, in some respects. Again, these are people who blended in with their communities, and their eccentricities were treated as such rather than examined for what it really was. And I think you're right. That is something that needs to happen. I think my earlier point was that the Guidestones themselves are not as intimidating and mysterious and ooh, eerie, spooky as people might make them out to be. But the ideology behind them, of course, is ultimately evil. And people should, I'm sure, the corporate report listeners will not be surprised to find out it's rabid racist eugenicists or adherents to that philosophy who are behind this. But again, I think it's somewhat relieving to know it's not the Darwins and Wedgwoods and people who are intimately involved with that who are behind these. It's just a couple of prominent, but still, you know, people who are in utter obscurity in the rest of the country.
Right. Well, the other thing is still that's an unknown is, and this was at the conclusion of the documentary, were guys like Shockley involved in this small circle of people? Were there other people? I've come across rumors that other Nobel laureates had connection with this man known as R.C. Christian. Were there other people who were more prominent that maybe had a peripheral role? And I hope that this is a catalyst for other people maybe to step forward, including people that may be even relatives of these men, and say, yes, we came across documents that showed these other people were at least sympathetic to the cause or not. It may be nothing more than just a few gentlemen who had extra money to spend that wanted to preserve their legacy, and that may be the end of it. If there's more to it, I hope that this could actually push it forward. You know, another name that I'll throw out to your audience that came out that was mentioned. In fact, I found the gentleman, R.C. Christian, writing in a prominent newspaper his support for David Duke. which was totally incongruous with his role as this prominent surgeon and city father, going out on the record. And we had gentlemen who knew him in town before I had revealed this information to them, talked about his comments speaking in support of David Duke. So it's not something completely charming and innocuous when you see this. I think the Guidestones is really more a symptom than the problem. It is the rash that occurs on the skin that you find out something worse is going on underneath.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
And when you don't really notice it, you feel fine, everything seems to be moving along, but there's something not right, and a symptom like this pops up now and then, and it's worthy for us, and I know your show and a few others on the internet do a credible job of looking for those little symptoms and trying to understand what is the root of what's coming from them. Some of them have deeper roots, some of them lesser so, but it's a worthy effort to explore all of them to see what we are as human beings.
Right. Well, exactly. And if nothing else, if this documentary gets people to spend perhaps a little less time going and protesting at rocks and actually protesting the people and the ideology behind them, I think that might be constructive in its own way. But I will leave that for viewers of this documentary to come to their own conclusions about that. Once again, it's called Dark Clouds Over Elberton, The True Story of the Georgia Guidestones. I will have a link to the trailer as well as the documentary itself at doulafilms.com/darkclouds.html. That link will be in the show notes as well, so people can go and get their copy of this documentary. But before we let you go, Dr. Bennett, I would be remiss in my duties if I didn't let you discuss a project which has been discussed a few times on Revelations Radio News now, somewhat in good humor. But I understand you're working on a book or a series of books, volumes of books that are taking decades, centuries to write? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that's hyperbole on the part of Andrew and Tim, but it seems to be taking a while.
I don't want you to become part of the Kilkenny Hoffman cabal that is there to be my thorn in the flesh. Thank goodness everyone's been supportive except these gentlemen. And I do not want them to be a negative influence to you. This is something that has become a real quest of mine, and one of the reasons why I hung up the microphone with FutureQuake after 7 years and 300 shows, I didn't want to jump the shark with FutureQuake. You and I could both list a long list of people who are prominent and well-known in our area who really don't have that much more to add, but they got to keep the system running and the organization going so they get more and more sensationalistic. And really, I felt it was time back in early 2002 that I needed to focus on writing about something that greatly disturbed me. And a lot of it came from my religious culture that I was from, but just from American culture in general. And that was the ever-increasing animosity between people of different religious cultures and different spheres of the world. And what we keep are being told is the clash of civilizations that we now know as the war on terror. And as a person of faith, I felt that the actions I saw were completely betraying the founders of my faith. So I began what I thought was going to be a single book volume looking at what is going on today in the war on terror, and particularly the involvement of American citizens in the religious community vis-a-vis what their founders of their faith said was supposed to be an approach of people of other cultures and types. And it grew into a modest 6-volume series, which I'm now trying to finish. I'm on the next to last volume right now. I'm writing about the Crusades currently in the history of it. But it looks at every facet. It's called The Holy War Chronicles, A Spiritual View of the War on Terror. And I think you'll be interested to know some of the information that comes out. Some of this may be old hat to your audience because they're the most educated people on the planet on these things. But I begin by delving in the roots in the early 20th century, late 19th, of Islamic extremist and pan-Islamism started by British intelligence as a way to divert the secular independence movements, anti-colonial movements in the Arab world. And how groups like the Muslim Brotherhood were set up through Alef Ghani and his people who came after him under British control and support to divert that support away from other gentlemen like Nasser and others, how the Americans got involved with the Wahhabis to support the House of Saud, and even admissions from Israeli officials, top officials, about their creation of Hamas for the same purpose, to counteract the senior PLO. And so I discussed about how the Taliban was trained in America in making roadside bombs by our Green Berets, the extremist literature that was found in their madrasas that was printed by the U.S. government. I try to find the roots of the main activities of the war on terror, including the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, which I've been able to trace back to the 1994 Defense Quadrennial Review that was proposed by Wolfowitz, not for any other purpose of extremism, religious extremism, but to stop Japan and Germany from building rival nuclear programs to protect themselves and thus become a rival economic power. And just a number of revelations that occur. Each volume has a different aspect it covers. The second volume concerns how we view the Middle East and who are the gatekeepers of our media that control how we characterize and stigmatize the people of the Middle East. I talk about the overseas intelligence groups that control the only two major organizations that translate Arab documents. I get into homegrown terror, domestic terror in the U.S., and in fact, even talk about, I don't know if you've talked about this in your show much, but back in the early 70s, how the FBI had actually trained a militia group called the Minutemen to bomb the 1972 Republican Convention and massacre the Republican delegates to be blamed on Vietnam veterans against the war. In the aftermath of that, FBI's involvement at the roots of the Black Panthers and their founding, and a host of other things like that, and then really get more into a religious history in Judaism and Christianity and how they keep making the same errors today, and then conclude with some of the key players and actors now and how there's even been a revival in the top Christian figures here and reviving a crusade officially with knighthood and swords and going back and refighting the Crusades through some quiet ceremonies that they do now that have now been uncovered recently. And so things get pretty ludicrous. It gets to look like the Dr. Strangelove kind of environment occurring now.
Yeah, and, absolutely unbelievable. But I assume the footnotes themselves are going to take a few hundred pages for this.
Oh, there's not a single reference in the book. It's all off the top of my head. Now there are more footnotes than anybody dares to look at. There's many, many thousands. Hence why this is taking so long. I'm cranking out, you know, each of these volumes, the last few have been around 700 pages. So
unbelievable.
I feel like I'm doing pretty good to crank out one manuscript a year.
Yeah.
And so I'm halfway through the next to last one. I also have another spinoff one called The Hidden Hand Against the God-Fearers. And its premise is a spinoff of this. When I find out that people who wear turbans and live in caves are not the main threat to the Western world, it turns out that the main threat to our way of life and our beliefs are actually people who wear suits, sometimes even set in our churches. But they're the people who decide when we have our wars in the world, who has economic benefit and who has bankruptcy in parts of the world, who controls the money for foundations and the agenda for population rises and falls on different spheres of the world, and whose power dwarfs these small extremist groups that we've been trained to fear so much. So that's a whole separate book that comes on the tail end of this as well, that's ready out of the gate.
Well, if this is anything like the well-researched documentary you've put together on the Georgia Guidestones, I very much will be looking forward to it. So I will do my best to let people know when it's available. In the meantime, how can people become acquainted with your previous work at FutureQuake?
Well, thank you again for that opportunity. Future Quake was a 7-year radio show that was really just an education process for me. If you watch listen to the earlier years, you can find I've come a long way, baby, in terms of my view of the issues and things. But you're free to listen to the whole mess, and most people listen to the entire archive of 7 years. And to check it out, you can go to futurequake.com. It's like earthquake, but it's futurequake.com. My email address is there if you want to make contact with me. But all 300 shows, most of them are 2 hours plus in length on different topics. If you like what you hear on the Corbett Report and you want to hear just a dumbed down version, go check out Future Quake and you'll find out a more primitive version there. But some very fascinating interviews with people that have not been captured before. And I would encourage people who are truth seekers that listen to your show, our common kinfolk with our Futurians at Future Quake, and it would be a thrill for me to get to meet them.
Excellent. Well, thank you for coming on today, and thank you for your participation in, I suppose, a chapter of history, really, uncovering the real identities behind the Georgia Guidestones. Once again, people can check it out, Dark Clouds Over Elberton, the true story of the Georgia Guidestones. All the links in the show notes, as usual. Dr. Bennett, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.